Either your back cat or ours. Okay, listen, just open to whatever. I'd love to hear additions or subtractions or whatever anyone would like to kick in. First of all, does anyone know, someone just asked me, does anyone know a good biography of Wilberforce?
Eric McTaxis has written a great one.
Ah, Eric McTaxis. Good. Because he's a good biographer. Did someone, who was asking?
There's a film about him, Amazing Grace.
Yes, that's right.
Excellent.
Yeah. Is it, who was asking that?
Someone? I did.
Yes, okay. Yeah, you know Eric McTaxis, yeah. Good. That must be, is that pretty recent, since it's Bonhoeffer one?
It's in the last two years.
Great. Good. But it's just really, I mean, and don't minimize the role of the community with him, because he's such a sort of a total extrovert and knew everybody and did everything, but would have been utterly impossible without this community that he worked, not just everybody sort of feeding him, but all sorts of people were out doing really, really powerful things who were part of this community too. So yeah.
Next question.
Yeah.
Okay. I keep thinking about worship, both last night, the emphasis of that in Revelation, Marty talking about the significance of worship in catechesis, you mentioned worship as part of the Clapham group gathering, and I'm thinking the centrality of worship in monasteries and the life of prayer. And so I know we just need more informing our understanding of what worship is, and then and I'm wondering, like, what do we rightly expect that worship does, the act of it, and in us, in shaping our imagination, shaping our engagement with the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is sort of a weird angle to take, but worship is the last thing in the world that would want to find an instrumental value for it. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Worship, one of my professors said this, which is really interesting. Worship is the only thing you can do with everything you got without reservation, without idolatry.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you repeat that for
me? I think I was Ed Clowney. Worship is the only thing you can do of all the human activities with everything you've got, every bit of your passion and everything that you can do without it being idolatry. Because it's just simply directly connecting with God, who is the God, who is God, and the one that we're meant to worship, and without reservation. And so what you've asked is a good question, but I'm just guarding against worshiping in order to do something that our worship will produce as a product of worship, because I'm worshiping because it will produce this, all these good things. No, worship is for worship. It will produce all do all sorts of jobs, but I think it's important to say it's the one thing we can do, which we need to first do it because we it's right to do it, because God is worthy of our worship. You know, all the hymns are talking about God's worthiness of worship. And that means we're not doing God any favor. We're not being specially cool or good or commendable Christians by worshiping Him. We're just simply recognizing the truth about who we are and who He is. And this is just totally due Him. Now, having said that, I think it impacts everything. And again, what is worship? It's hard to restrict it. It's the word has to do with service, and activity is seen as worship. Our work is seen as a kind of worship. Certainly, prayer can be worship, adoration. Having frowned on the idea of byproduct, one byproduct I find is that it reorders your world. which is forever getting disordered. And I think this means it impacts all our activities and concerns and passions and so forth. And if we worship properly, we are, okay, God, that's, God is God. We're very recent occurrences, haven't been around very long, won't even stay around very long, are very fragile, are created, not self-created. And I think of the thing Schaefer used to say, every Christian must bow twice. Once as a creature, being acknowledging complete dependence on their Creator, and we're nothing in ourselves, in our own generation, anything else like this. And then secondly, morally, that we need forgiveness and we need mercy. And so I think any worship of God has got to involve those, that reordering of our human awareness, because it must teach us who we are, or reteach us who we are, reaffirm for us who we are. It establishes who we are as we worship God. And that must make sense of and put everything else, insofar as we do it, in a perspective that we need. That's why I think it's right to go to church on Sundays, to get reordered by our worship, and we need other people to be with us and to lead us and to help us and so forth. But the idea of worship is so broad. It's got to do with your sincerity and what you're working, whether you're preparing a meal or chopping wood or carrying whatever or driving a car. It's got to do with your prayer life. It's got to do with the things that you yearn for. It affects all those, and which I think, so without it, we're much more likely a loose cannon spiritually ourselves. In other words, careening around, that term loose cannon is that a familiar term? Mm-hmm. But what it comes from is on shipboard of a naval ship where they shot cannons that were on rollers, where you've probably seen them, where the cannon goes boom and the whole carriage of the cannon recoils back and is on ropes, and then you swab the cannon out and so on. A loose cannon is a cannon that weighs hundreds, thousands of pounds in a stormy sea, on the ship's deck going like this, which is loose, it's not tied down. So it's careening from one end of the side of the deck, careening back to the other, as the ship rocks like this. So it's super dangerous. A loose cannon is very, very dangerous. It's a huge weight on wheels going, you know, not where. And so that's what we're like when we're not grounded with an ordering of our priorities and so on. So in terms of this discussion, I think it's so important. You think of the Civil Rights Movement. Josh was talking about it last night, the worship in the Civil Rights Movement. They would spend several hours singing gospel music before they would go out on the street and get beaten up or whatever happened to them. But that was really important, that they were worshiping and calling on God and using music as a way to be able to be nonviolent, to have to keep loving the people who were whatever. And so that's not just a sort of a psychological trick. There's something very deep, theologically deep, I think, about that, about getting grounded about who I am, what I'm doing, what I'm about, by our worship of God. But I'd love to hear other people's thoughts on that, because it's a very rich question that could go in all sorts of directions. Yeah.
I've been thinking about worship since last night, too, since Josh's talk, and I just wondered if Josh, I'm thinking, correct me, but when he was talking about how the main two commands in chapters 6 to 16 or whatever are look, behold, and do not be afraid, and that it just struck me that worship is us looking again and beholding God, and that reorders everything. You know, he was saying, we don't know that God is sovereign just by looking around us. Yeah. So we look and we behold everything around us.
Looks the other way, actually. But it seems the other way.
Yeah, it seems the opposite. But only if we look at the throne room, only if we look at God, then we know who He is, because He reveals it to us, and then we cannot be afraid. So it seems like worship enables us again, if we do it well, to look and see God. Yeah.
Yep.
And as you say, everything gets rewarded.
Yeah. And that brings in what we talked about last night also, imagination. I desperately want to redeem the imagination. And it's important to understand that, I think, because your imagination enables you to see, internally at least, what isn't there in front of you. Mm-hmm. That means you can see unicorns and elves, but it also means you can see God. In other words, you can see what isn't there because you imagined it to be there. But it's also used and super important for seeing what isn't right there to your senses, but is there. And that's what we need. We need a huge redemption retrieval of our imagination to take God's turn. That's why we're meant to become like little children, right? One of the key things they've got is a better imagination than we do. It gets educated out of us or pounded out of us or something. They can take seriously what they can't see because we tell them it's there. They, okay, yeah, I can pray. Yeah, I'll pray to God. And it's real to them in a way that it isn't secularized out of us as adults. And so I think the imagination isn't just something of laying hold of fantasy at all. It is that. That's wonderful. But it's laying hold of what's there, but we can't see it. And so it's a retrieving of the imagination. And it's also in the ordering, too. I just often think of, this is weird maybe, but Dickens' Christmas Carol, okay? What happens to Scrooge in the whole course of that thing? He gets, his imagination comes alive. He can see something bigger than just his counting house. And the whole thing, the different angels or different gods or whatever, just open his world, and he's able to see the past when he couldn't. And it's just a huge imaginative exercise, so he can, everything he can see that he couldn't see before, because his commercialism and his greed had just shut him down and shriveled his imagination down to nothing. But that's where the growth of the imagination is so important. But I think worship is feeding that and helping that. Cody, you had something.
Well, I was just going to ask kind of a clarifying question. Is what we're kind of talking about right now is kind of related to, I guess, sanctification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's part of sanctification is being able to worship, and that feeds our sanctification, our growth in that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
What I was thinking about worship is what gets in the way of it, and I think of, for instance, Emerson's essay on self-reliance, and we are tremendously schooled in relying on our own intellectual, our own understanding of the world, our own social empowerment, the decisions we make, the money we make, and worship runs dead set against that because it's not self. And what do you come down to when you read the scripture or you understand something that you've never understood before, and you stand in awe in front of God? And to me, something that clicked for me was that it's admiration, trust, love, dependency on something you do not understand. You don't comprehend God. You are not omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. You never will be, but He is, and He loves you, and He is focused on you. And like the child at the mother's breast, or the child learning something for the first time, you stand in awe, and you don't have to compete, you don't have to measure up, you just go, wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. I think one of the dangers of Emerson is we've got to be original. The demand to be original is an absolute curse.
I was interested in what you were saying about the reordering that worship can bring about. I was just thinking about this a little while ago, how our fears need to be reordered, because we've been talking about fear, and I was wondering if you could comment on how fear of God, which is something that is lifted up throughout the Bible, is a good thing, a sign of a righteous person, someone who fears God, what that means in the context of all the other things we're afraid of, and how does worship reorder that, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. The the best handle I have on the fear of God is rock from rock climbing. just that you can stand at the top of a rock face that may drop 500 feet or about a long way below you, and you can tie yourself in so you're absolutely secure. Nothing's going to bite you. And yet you can go tied in to the edge of the rock, and your breath gets taken away by the what's there. Or you can be at the bottom of the rock and look up, and the majesty of the thing that's there. You're perfectly safe. Your safety is guaranteed, but there's something that requires you to catch your breath and that is fearful. And because, I mean, either the rock you're looking at, as it come down on you, or something come down, or you're standing at the top, you can fall off. It ought to be feared. Goodness knows, it's crazy not to be, to not be, not just in awe, but fear. There's something that's actually dangerous. And I think that's how I see the fear of God. Although with God, there's love mixed in. And the whole gospel is what is safety for you, and so you're not trembling and expecting to be sort of destroyed any moment. And yet, I think the distinctive thing about the fear of God is that it then casts out other fears. It diminishes other fears. That are no longer, not that you don't experience them at all, but they don't dominate you, because we're in this really for God, and I will live as long as He wants me to live, and it's Him that's my basic orientation and the source of my life and my survival and everything else. So it seems to me that the fear of God must order our other fears, whether it be, as we talk about today, social alienation, and marginalization, or persecution, or life itself, and it's that we know Him who's in control of the whole business, and we fear Him, know Him, respect Him, are in awe of Him, and that minimizes the amount of control other fears can have. Fear is basically an adaptive emotion. It's basically not a bad thing. It's what makes you jump back from the curb if a car is driving too close to you, and do all sorts of other wise things. Fear is not something you want to obliterate, or say is always neurotic. There's also things we ought to be afraid of doing because they're bad things to do. But we shouldn't be dominated and controlled by those. And I think what I'm arguing here in this talk is fear controlling us to deal with our aloneness, our marginalization, our minority status, or whatever, that we're not part of the ruling party or something like this. But that enables us to keep on being salt and light, not to run away from being salt and light, because it's more dangerous to be there holding on to God's truth and to who God is. Yeah, that's. Any other thoughts on the fear of God? Because that's another massive, big question that we sometimes have. Good.
I haven't quite worked out how to articulate this, but I keep coming back to that God is personal, and so the fear of God actually puts us into a relationship with one that can speak to us and quell our fears, and so. The fear that we have of other things holds its power by depersonalized nature, and that fear is able to dominate. It feeds off our fear. Mm-hmm. Fear feeds off our fear. I think that's where the command to not be afraid, when Jesus says, you know, take heart and die. Do not be afraid. To fear Him means that we can have our fears put to rest. Mm-hmm. It puts us in a position to be to be addressed.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I'm thinking of that in relationship to worship too, to that seeing, to looking, to gazing upon God, and to somehow in that too, the gaze is returned. Mm-hmm. We are seeing as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's that's only possible because God is a person. And a person who really cares for us. Because, as Marty said this morning, the polytheistic gods are more or less personal, but don't care. You know, they care for maybe the rich people in Rome, maybe the centurial class, patrician class. They don't care for the poor. And they say so, and that's not a, you know, a slander. That's the way the whole thing is written. And so they're no help. Because they don't love you, they don't care for you. So I think it's really, or as you say, an impersonal. That's a challenge people face today, without belief in a personal God, and who cares? And people don't want to face that who caresness. And there's nothing that cares. And I love the psalm that says, "What is it? Look to the mountains." From whence comes your help? So look at the mountains, and then don't look to the mountains for help. Be inspired by the mountains, but then look to the Lord for help, because the mountains don't care about you. They really don't give a rip about who you are or your well-being or anything else. But it's God who does. So look to the mountains for inspiration and for awe and wonder, but you look to God for help, because that's all impersonal. So all those things are pieces of the puzzle, aren't they? Yeah, Abby.
Well, the way I understand it is that if you live with the mind dominated by fear, your tendency is to throw up walls and to control things. And worship is the opposite. You recognize that you are vulnerable to, and you can't put up walls, and you can't control. Mm-hmm. And it's frightening for us who are used to controlling things and putting up walls protecting ourselves when we deal with that. Mm-hmm. And it's a different kind of fear because as you trust God, the more you trust Him, and then it evolves into something else. But that wanting to control and that putting up walls thing is what most people are used to. They're so comfortable with that. You get someone in their life where they have to actually be vulnerable to, they can feel very threatened. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who cannot form relationships because they're too dominated by fear.
Mm-hmm.
But worship is the practice of being vulnerable to them.
And we can worship God and still keep all those barriers involved for other people. You know,
yeah.
Although worship of God ought to help us,
yeah.
Ought to help us in it and make us willing to risk more, but it's perfectly possible to worship God or even use Christian truth to build walls around ourselves.
Yeah.
Use God's truth to.
I thought about a scripture, and I can't remember exactly where it is, but it says, "Neither fear ye nor fear." I think about that in terms of how fear is contagious.
Mm-hmm.
People have fear, and you pick up on fear, and you buy into the fear. But, you know, God knows about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not fearing God. That's talking about mm-hmm. general fear of bad things happening.
Yeah.
And I think that we do that in our culture, especially right now. I think people, it's contagious fear.
That's right.
And I also thought about worship and praise, and I know they're two different words. But I think it's in 2 Chronicles 20, they were fighting Jehoshaphat, and they were fighting one of the armies they had to fight, and the singers, went out before the army, and they praised God, and of course, the battle was theirs, and they didn't even have to fight it. But the praise must have, and the music and the singing must have really built their excitement, they're believing, they're trusting in God so greatly
mm-hmm.
that they were able to win that battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know, I know you said that we praise just because God is good and we worship because God is good. But I always think of that account because I think mm-hmm. it helped them win the battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. right? And it, but it's worshiping God for God, and that was the byproduct.
That was
Marty.
I'm just thinking of what the Bible says about the fear of God and what everybody's saying is so important, and then wondering how to regain that. Thinking of what you said about Christian Smith, what was the phrase that he said? That teenagers moralistic
therapeutic
idea that's the bottom line understanding of God is, you know, I'm going to be good and God really wants me to be happy, and how far that is from the fear of God. How do we in our churches get the fear of God back, the right kind of fear of God back? And this is a massive question. And how do we train up little ones so they have the right understanding of God, Scripture talks about trembling before His word. And again, it's not, I like your illustration, your rock climbing illustration, but just a sense that it's a fearful thing to make light of what God says is the way we're meant to live, or what He says about how we're meant to use our bodies or our money, or things that, you know, the idolatry of today. And God doesn't just want us to be happy. It's not that He doesn't want us to be happy, but that we're going to know joy and happiness in the deepest sense as we honor Him. But it's not going to be this lightweight happiness of what, you know, He wants to give me what I want.
I don't think there's any one answer to that, because that's a huge issue. But I mean, could it be? This is just a sort of one-off thought. But could it be that part of that is young people really don't experience that much of the world, the real world? Which I thought of taking kids rock climbing. That's the real world. That's actually something that's quite bigger than I am and threatening. Not that that's the solution, but I just think some of the kids we took rock climbing, and it radically improved our Bible study. radically. And because there's a humility in that and an interdependence, because you're on the same rope. That's not my solution. but just kids are so much in their electronic world, so little reality that really pushes back, the world pushes back. You know, we're not free to just make ourselves into who we want to be and then go ahead and do it. No, we don't get away with that because the real world reality pushes back.
I wonder if that just made me think of the importance of getting out in God's creation.
Mm-hmm.
And how important that is. I remember when Ben organized in his high school to have this guy bring in birds of prey and some of the students who were they'd sort of been thinking bird watching, who's interested in birds, and suddenly in the same room with what kind of birds, then an eagle with a huge wingspan. At least they were really sobered and just blown away by something that, again, part of God's creation that can certainly you know, the kids I know who've grown up exposed to the creation, the natural world, have an amazing curiosity and excitement to know more, a hunger to know more and learn more about its creation.
This is sort of under the faithfulness isn't what we're called faithfulness and not winning. But so often we look for fruit in our life as a sign of winning.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question of your comment of we need being faithful and building fruit in our life no matter what, if we are being faithful.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are doing what you feel like you're being called to do and you don't see fruit, should you keep on going? Or and think, well, I don't get to always see the fruit of my life. Or what we also see is people who are doing what they should not be doing and they're still fruit. So where's the discernment there? I love the idea that we are called to faithfulness. I'm not winning. I feel like there's so much freedom in that. And there's so much of God's grace and mercy in that, that freedom isn't winning. But how do we get out of the mindset of winning? Because that, numbers, even the missions committee wants numbers. And to me, that is really awful that is what they ask, is that they want to know our numbers. So, is that wrong? How many people have you
asked
the Lord, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know an avocado takes 9 months to mature? I didn't say green the entire time. It doesn't look like a ripe fruit for most of the time. Some fruit fruit takes a long time to mature. But it can always give you instant sort of results.
The other thing is, what is fruit? And it's got to be, I think we don't really grapple with the psychological impact of Jesus saying the first will be last and the last will be first. And in other words, our scorekeepers in our society really, really have it wrong. Sports Illustrated, Wall Street Journal, Fortune Magazine, whatever, really, really have it wrong. People Magazine. Whatever. What?
Upside down.
Yeah. Not just mistaken, but inverted. And so we've got to really have a clear sense of what is fruit in the first place and what would I recognize as fruit in my own life. But oftentimes it's tricky because oftentimes we are the world's worst person to evaluate our own fruitfulness and our growth. Because we're so screwed up in negating ourselves and whatever, not taking approve of anything I do myself is just pride and arrogance, and I'm falling into all these things. But we've got to separate ourselves from the winning, is the way the world conceives of it. But yet take seriously another kind of winning that I. Maybe I'm not bothered by my failure to do this or that or whatever as much as I had been. But I find it very difficult to know how to. The existence of humility as one of the central sort of I call it a gateway virtue of the Christian faith is really tricky, because what happens if you think you've one on humility. what do you dare to approve of yourself at all in terms of your humility? That means you've got to, in a sense, in terms of your evaluating mechanisms, leave that alone. Get out of there and get on with living. And never mind the calculus on quantitative analysis of your humility, because we can only just get worse, tied in knots there. I often think of you think of how humble you were that you weren't bugged by someone not inviting you to do something or something like this, and then you thought, wow, I was. Most people would really ticked off with this, but I'm humble enough to not be bothered by it. And then you think, that's pride itself. That's pride coming in the back door. And then you say, well, not many people would be sensitive enough to have a back door. And so we can go on forever. And it's an infinite regress. So I think we just got to leave that alone. And sometimes, for certain people, I think this is to do with our own temperament and experience. And so some people have to just leave that, the whole idea alone of evaluating themselves in this, of their progress. I mean, Lewis has this great illustration of pulling a plant up every day by the roots to check the root development, putting it down, and it's not growing anywhere. Yeah, that's still not growing anywhere. And saying that's what we do is we check our spiritual growth, because we're focusing on us and our growth, not on just God, for crying out loud. And just follow Him and obey Him and get on with it, and never mind the introspection. So some of us like to be need to be very careful about introspection itself and evaluate. Trust God that I'm doing what He wants to do. He's going to deal with it. I've got a couple of hands in the air. Julia, did you have something?
This is just something aside from already comments on fear of God, and especially like training up children to have a fear of God. And I think I'm a perfect parent because I don't have any children to prove it. But I think showing courage against things that many others are afraid of is a good way to teach a healthy fear of God. And like I would say, I came from more of a tribal kind of a family with that kind of Christianity, and just like fear of government or fear of society encroaching upon our rights, or fear of this book or poetry that's hard to understand, or fear of this kind of music or that kind of dance. Like so many things to be afraid of and to avoid. I think has convoluted a lot of my ideas of what a healthy fear of God is. So, like, even referring back to your talk of having a contempt for death, like having courage in the face of even death, because we have the right thing to fear in our minds.
Thank you. That's good. Yes.
I was just going to say, I think another way to kind of evaluate where we are without being that, because I totally lived under that, am I doing enough? Am I being prideful? Am I being humble? And that cycle can just be very unproductive. But I think that's where discipleship and that community aspect is so essential and important, because people walking alongside of you and being able to coach you in ways that will honor God and look more like Jesus, it takes you away from yourself and you're focusing on a bigger thing. And I think a big part of something that I think is super challenging right now in just life is finding time for good discipleship, especially with youth and young people, because the world just demands a lot from them. But I think there's such a benefit to mentorship and discipleship. It covers, learning, going through scriptures, it covers that relationship, it covers that aspect of daily living that can be really a great growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I want to put in a two bits comment on discipleship. That it's interesting to me. The Gospels are filled with the disciples did this, the disciples did that, and discipleship and so on. It's mentioned once in the Book of Acts, the disciples in Ephesus or something like, as just designated Christians. The model in the letters is not mentioned. The model in the letters is the imitation of Christ. And so I think I agree totally in discipleship, but I think discipleship should be done with more awareness that of Paul when he says, imitate me as I imitate Christ, which means not I'm the ideal, look at me, but insofar as I'm Christ-like, watch me, that's a visual aid for you. And so anybody can be a visual aid for somebody else in their Christ-likeness, but Christ is the focus, not me. And so I think I've seen in earlier times particularly, discipleship for young people particularly is everybody becomes like the youth leader. And you've got to become like the youth leader, and he or she is the center of attention and focus. Whereas I think the people doing the discipling need to be aware of Jesus is the focus. The imitation of Christ is where it's at. And if I'm can help you in that, that's great. And another biblical passage which is really helpful to me is in, I think it's Hebrews 13:7, which is, look at your leaders, those who brought you the word of God. Look at the result of their life and imitate their faith. Don't imitate their life. You can't possibly imitate their life. You'll mess your head up, all up, trying to imitate their life. You don't have their gift. You don't have their genetic endowment. You don't have anything that they have in terms of their particular personality. But you can look at their faith and their relationship to God and their trust in God, and that will stretch you rather than tie you in knots. And so, and looking for how they are Christ-like, which will stretch you. So discipleship is what's needed, but we need to understand it in terms of it's toward Christ. Christ is still the one we're to be apprentices of. Yes?
I'm thinking of how here in the States we really value success, like visible results, like the fruit that you were talking about, Nikki. And even as Christians, we want to be successful Christians, which looks like fruitful Christians. We have something visible to show that can be measured and applauded, or at least we can appreciate. And how, like, I think it can be, that can kind of motivate us toward comparison at times, looking at the world or looking at other Christians. And something that just came to mind, which takes us back to the place of worship, is Psalm 73, where he says, "Blessed are the pure in heart." I had to start writing it down because I knew I wouldn't get it out, but I have it a little bit in my head. "As for me, my foot had almost slipped. I nearly lost my way because I envied the arrogant. They are free from my burdens." And he goes on about their death has no pain. Like, everything is easy for them. They seem basically incredibly successful. And then he acknowledges, I don't remember the transitions really smoothly, but like, he realizes, "I almost became like a beast before you," like lamenting my own smallness as I look to everybody else's success. But the solution, he says, is, "Then I entered your holy place." And I wish I remembered the words more clearly, but he does say, like, "And I saw their destiny." And then he goes on to say, as for me, your goodness, my God, is my good." And he kind of transfers from, what does my life look like on the outside, and to, who am I near? Who am I abiding with? It just seemed like that song kind of draws together a lot of the things that we're talking about.
That's helpful. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yes, Steve.
I've seen one of the best examples of bearing fruit in one of my partners, and he has never given thought to the idea of bearing fruit. His whole focus was, "I'm called to serve the Lord. Am I doing what God wants me to do?" And I've seen him affect the lives of churches just through his service of the Lord. I've seen him help the needy because he thought that's what God called him to. I've seen him help the troubled because that's what God had called him to. And I saw him a couple of times challenged by pastors saying, "Are you bearing fruit?" And his response was, "I don't know. God will tell me when the day has come." He said, "My goal is not to bear fruit. My God is to obey. My goal is to obey God." And without even giving thought to fruit, his whole focus was on obedience to God. And I have another partner, as far as success is concerned. He could have gone with one of the major national law firms. But as he thought about it, he knew he would be compromised by going with it. And he would have made enormous amounts of money. But he decided that his service to God was more important. And ministering to his family and being of service in his local congregation was more important. Making a lot of money. Now he's been successful, but not nearly as successful as he could have been. And he made that decision as a young man in his late 20s. And I've seen it bear fruit because he's affecting lives as well.
Yeah, that's good, yes.
It's just going off of that first example, you think of Jeremiah, who never had a convert and no one ever listened to him.
Just threw him in a well, threw stuff at him, beat him up.
And yet his life was fruitful. He did what God called him to do. It's a great
example. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. The other one I thought of was Noah. You know, what did the people, what did his wife think of him? Mm-hmm. Building this boat for what? For like 100 years. What did his employees think of him? How many people walked out of him? He was called a preacher of righteousness. He was talking the talk while he was building that silly thing. So, and, you know, getting back to Reinhold Niebuhr, you know, talking about a project you couldn't hardly do in your whole life, you know, it was not until the final that anyone said, he had it right, we had it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And so often it's not what we're, you know, what we're actually doing, which counts for God, is not the very thing we're aiming at and we think we're here for, I don't know quite how to live with that and just keep renewing that awareness. It's something we need to renew in our awareness again and again, I think, to remind ourselves that what we're doing. I remember Edith Schaefer once asked, I think we were sitting around the table or something, and what do you think is the most important day of your life? And I think she suggested at the end, it's probably a day you don't remember. Mm-hmm. You probably did something, said something, whatever, to somebody that ended up being really important in their life, downstream, whatever. And we don't need to know. We don't need to know, but we do need to be faithful each day. So that's a sort of a humility before history that we need, I think, which is really, Ben?
I was thinking if anybody had thought on, I know we're all prone to buying into this idea of success connected with fruit, the fact is, I mean, there's a lot of Christian rhetoric today that really does, I guess it's going back to something you were saying earlier about sort of politically defending the interests of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what Christians are supposed to do. And within that context, if that's our main goal as Christians in terms of political action, to defend our interests, that makes sense within this context of success is fruit. Persuade ourselves and persuade others that that's not the way. I mean, I suppose it's almost like apologetics within the church in terms of how do we begin or go about winning the church back to this vision of it's the least, the little, the left hand of God, basically, is sort of where it's at. Because this is an in-house conversation between Christians. And I don't know how willing to be convinced people are that, you know, actually it's not our ultimate goal to get the right person in the office, in the right political office necessarily. But it's hard for that argument to sound plausible in the current climate.
Yeah.
And I just I'm totally open ended. Anybody?
Yeah, that's
teaching the Lyme disease. We've been teaching a lot about those left hand of God kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a home fellowship. Okay. We meet maybe 2 or 3 times a month. But, you know, we've taught a lot of other things over the years and we've discussed, but we realized that for us, there has been a dearth of this kind of teaching. For us, ourselves, we have been reproved and sort of confronted by our own, you know, success-oriented kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so we just made up our mind that we're going to do this. And mm-hmm. I don't know if people are going to change their thinking. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And we can't teach good politicians. But we're not doing that. But we're just teaching what we believe God wants us to teach. Mm-hmm. And,
I'd like to just take, because I was wanting to spin the discussion a bit in this direction anyway. If we think of the Wilberforce option being part of, at least part of what we need to be thinking of, we need to be involved in more than just our own interests, because then we are First of all, because it's pleasing to God to be involved in more than just our own. But secondly, because we'll otherwise be perceived as just one more special interest group along K Street in Washington, just as a lobbyist for ourselves, along with Dow Chemical and General Motors and whatever. But okay, what do you see going on in terms of engagement in the society, in terms of Christians doing things that you all are doing, beyond the church, beyond the door, beyond the what sort of examples do you see? Because I think we need to be, as I said, there's a whole lot of ways in which human dignity is being denied all over us today. And what can we do? Where can we turn? How can we be of help? What exactly? Any of you doing things particularly? And if you connected with people who are doing things, Mary Frances.
I'm sure a lot of people in this room are familiar with this. The one that pops to my head immediately is IJM, the International Justice Mission, which is a large organization started by one man who's a Christian, who's an attorney, worked in the State Department. He led the state. He was living in D.C., suburban life outside D.C. He led the State Department's investigation of the genocide in Rwanda, and came back and just thought, I can't unsee what I've seen, and I can't keep living the life I've been living, and he started IJM. And they're a huge organization. They're a Christian organization. They take the Christian call to justice very seriously, and they're doing really phenomenal work all over the world in freeing people from modern-day slavery, and sex trafficking rings, and they've also done work with land rights in Africa. And they're on Capitol Hill. They're lobbying there. I mean, they very much have a presence on Capitol Hill in the government, and they're very well known, they're very well respected, and they have a voice.
Yeah. Yes.
I ran across an intentional Christian community in Philadelphia called The Simple Way, and their main philosophy is to do things well with love. And it doesn't matter how little it is. So they're committed to just serving their little neighborhood, becoming part of the neighborhood, talking to the people, and enabling the neighborhood to help themselves. Mm-hmm. And they're interdenominational, but it's Roman Catholic and Protestant. Mm-hmm. And it really exemplifies the love of God. Mm-hmm. Idea that they're committed to their little neighborhood and they'll help them. And the people there. It's very particular, but it's huge because they're not making a big thing of it, and they're trying to avoid the toxicity that you can have with charity coming in and doing everything for everyone.
Yes.
Cody has one of the things our church is involved with, and we're just one of several, up in Beverly, the North Shore, there's a group called Family Promise, and it works with homeless families. And instead of putting them up in hotels or motels or whatever, churches all over the whole North Shore have taken on hosting these families, maybe 3 to 4 families a week. And we sign up for 4 weeks a year, which is not a lot. But they stay every night in that week at our church. We give them dinner. We give them a place to sleep. We give them a place to, clean up. To have their children play in the morning.
In their own homes, people's own homes.
No, in our church. So
people would stay in the church.
They stay in our church.
I see.
And they have, we bring in, they have beds that they move around. Mm-hmm. But it's so much better than going to a motel where they have no opportunity to go and find a job. They go back to the main office and are trained in how to find a job or go to school. The children are, because their location is Beverly, they're allowed to stay in the school system that they were in before this all happened. Mm-hmm. And they've had a very good success rate, and I feel very happy that our church is doing this, and that we get to interact with these families 4 times a year, maybe less, because they may even move on from, hopefully they do quite often. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of success stories. But sure. I think it's a wonderful, and it's not necessarily a Christian group. It's just that
churches have bought
are the ones that are supporting them.
Cody, Justin?
Well, seems like the question, the answer that we've come to is if we're to worship God. The question then, I think, becomes, well, when do we do it? And if we're not doing it, why are we not? Yes, I mean...
Well, we've gone beyond worship, narrowly speaking, to deal with what to do in the world. But, both of those, when we do all of it.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead. So I am a campus minister at Fitchburg State, and one of the things that we've done is we've partnered with the Gay Straight Alliance for two events, one that we've done for 3 years, the second, this will be our second year. The first one is a thing called If You Really Knew Me. They do it in the high schools too. But the whole program is to get together in the room and kind of say, if you really knew me, you'd know that, you know, my parents were alcoholics, or, you know, I was abused, or whatever. And so this past year, they actually asked the Christian group if we would be leaders of their small group discussion. So that was quite shocking for many people. And then the second event is called Stop the Hate Week. So it's focused on bullying, and especially bullying LGBT community into the place where they commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And so the Gay Straight Alliance is doing a kind of a candlelight vigil type of thing, except you can't light candles on campus, so we give them little electronic ones.
That's
pretty carbon. Same idea.
Pretty dangerous.
But what we ended up doing on our end was we made these giant posters that came out really wonderful, because we have a guy that does graphics, that had pictures of kids and then their story of who they were and what happened. And so that was really shocking to a lot of people that we would go to that much time. It was quite a bit of time and effort for us to do that. And it was really beautiful the way it ended up coming out. So anyway, that's been
something. That's cool. Quite a challenge. I thought I saw a hand back. Was that yours, Julie? Okay. Sorry. I'm misaligning hands.
I'll just do things quickly. In the Hartford area, I'm involved in a group called the very long name, Interreligious Eco-Justice Network. and it's a group I've come to appreciate very much, not only because of their work to promote environmental stewardship and good wide consumption of natural resources, but also their work against environmental racism and mistreatment of poor communities and communities of color. And also the interreligious aspect has been very beneficial to me. There are Jews and Christians and Muslims and Hindus all working together, committed to caring for the environment and caring for their neighbor. And even just rubbing shoulders and going to talks and events and me being able to form relationships with people in different religions, has been great. And the distinction between the religions is very clear. They're very separate religions, and that almost highlight, you mentioned, going, becoming a part of a society that highlights the differences between religions, promoting pluralism.
And that's not a fearful thing.
Good for me, yeah.
which is wonderful.
Another thing that comes to mind is my sister's church in Oregon is quite a big church, and they have a good amount of money. They have the money to build a building, but they've intentionally chosen not to build a building. They intentionally choose to meet in the town's high school because they want to be in a place where everybody knows. You know, it's only one high school in the town, and they want to rent from the public school system. They want to put money back into the school system. Mm-hmm. They think that as a church, their money, rather than having a building that's used just a couple times a week, their money as a church would be better used to promote the good of public education.
Mm-hmm. Great. Sebastian, you
answer. Oh, I have a question in regards to kind of, you have those two models, and then you said the third option, kind of to address the situation of, find ourselves in this, common place. But I'm wondering, how can Christians across denominations come to a consensus about what is the best way to move forward in the sense of, is there... how do you find authority unified? Because there's supposedly a lot of evangelicals who want Donald Trump as president. There's a lot of all these different Christians. There's Christians who are the Evangelical Lutheran Church, a very large church that ordains clergymen, promote, has supports same-sex marriage. You have all these different opinions, all these different bearings, and it's kind of, is there any unifying authoritative, I would say, consensus? I mean, you would say the scriptures, but then everybody's interpreting the scriptures differently. And I feel at the time when Paul and the early church, they had an apostle giving them divine revelation in the churches and how they, this is the way they're supposed to do it. But I feel now, what do we do? Can there be divine revelation in the sense of how people can go forward in the best situation? And it's kind of, is it even possible to unify all these different views of the same authoritative text? Or is it just everybody has their own opinion? And I don't know if it seems like there's a lot of entropy within Christianity in the United States.
Okay, we were talking about this a bit over lunch with the group in the table there. I think you have to start with what is possible. And I don't, for example, feel that, you didn't raise this question, but the denominations are necessarily a sin. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a nightmare if there was one Christian denomination. I think the biggest one now, and from some of the troubles they get into, but with their sheer size and bureaucratic structure, I think, help. Thank God. There's not just all one massive Christian denomination that could give orders down and so on. I think, which was modeled really after the structure of the Roman Empire. I'm talking about the Catholic Church. Modeled after the structure of the Roman Empire. And I'm not repentant about denominations. Some of them I am, because they're schismatic and people separate on the drop of a hat. So I think we're going to be, there's not going to be an evangelical pope anytime soon. And I don't want to hang around waiting for that.
Authoritative, this is how evangelicals should move forward, because I feel even amongst evangelicals, between denominations, everybody has their own. Some people want to hold up, some people want to be...
I think there's room for both. I think there will be room for both. I think you have the Lausanne conference that happened, when did this first happen, in the 70s or 80s? Which is a pan-evangelical get-together. They've come up with a bunch of statements that I think are still important to different Christian denominations. Schaefer was there very much as a player in the first one, but it's carried on. And emphasize of what we take to be evangelical faith itself and what should we be concerned with. But that still allows a massive amount of freedom on these things to go where we want to go. And I think there needs to be room for, I think I'm glad there's not one Christian political party. I'm glad that Christians can be Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. And we need Christians in both parties. Mm-hmm. We need both emphases politically. And I mean, in this country, I hear, how can a Christian not be a Republican? In Europe, I hear, how can a Christian possibly be a Republican?
Or in our black church, how can a Christian ever be?
Yeah, even in our church, yeah. So, I want to get away from that kind of provincialism and say, there's plenty of room. And I think we can, a cause like this, like all sorts of different things, like the pro-life issues and so on, brings all kinds of Christians together who don't care if they're Baptists or Catholics or Presbyterians or whatever. They believe in the pro-life issues and they'll throw their way into it. So I don't want to be dependent on some idea of unity among us all and that we arrive on the right thing by virtue of our own agreement. I'd say let's move with what needs to be done. If we know it needs to be done and we think something's right, come along. Our students leave here and I wish we did a better job at preparing people to leave LaBrie and with a positive sense of, okay, this is what I want to do. But one of the things is my mantra, find somebody of like mind who doesn't think you're completely crazy for thinking these thoughts. Find a few people of like mind. Get together with them and see what can happen. And that's happened. It's amazing. I went out to spoke at where was it? I think it was the Azusa Pacific when I was up there. Students asked me to stop. I was speaking there, and students asked me to supper one night, which was their night of their get-together, which was to have a LaBrie discussion. And they were, there was about 10 or a dozen of them. All we got crammed ourselves in this room. Some of them had cooked a meal and so on. And a couple of them had been to Swiss Le Brie or to Granum or something. I don't think anyone had been here before. But they saw discussion of serious issues as something they really valued and wanted to spread this in their university setting. You know, I think that's awesome. You know, and that was just a handful. They didn't mess with the whole college that much, but hey, they got something going. And
and do you think that's possible in the sense of a broader amongst, you know, Republican Christians, Democrat Christians? You know, is that, it doesn't seem like there's a sense of in that unity that was kind of everybody coming to the table and having a reasonable discussion rather than just yelling that, you know, you're, you know,
I think that's going to go. The yelling is going to go on. I think. If our presidential election this might have any gauge of that, the yelling's going to go on. But we can't let that throw us off. We've got to get on with it. I mean, I think there are Republicans and Democrats who are pro-life and are doing stuff. They roll up their sleeves and are doing stuff. I think there are all sorts of all the childhood issues. The Republicans and Democrats both doing issues to do with fostering and adoption and so forth, which is another huge area where Christians are doing some really good stuff. It's really a very imaginative stuff. Our son's involved in it in Georgia and doing wonderful, wonderful work there. But that doesn't need party lines are irrelevant. Forget it. Just get on. And church denominational lines are irrelevant. Forget it. Methodists, Presbyterians, and so on, we can all get in and do something because it needs to be done. We all agree it needs to be done. So I think we could be in stasis forever if we wait for some pan-evangelical consensus, because I don't think that's likely, except on maybe on huge, but even on the pro-life issue, that's not there. So we need to get busy with what we've got, and accept what we've got is imperfect. But hey, everything is imperfect that we're going to touch as long as we're touching it. Maureen.
Yeah, I think that the way you talked about the Wilberforce model really being undergirded by the Benedictine model, the fact that it was a community, that Wilberforce was part of this community.
Not the Wilberforce model, but the Wilberforce reality.
The actual person accomplished a huge amount because of this community of people who were very diverse. And I was just thinking, I think that's so important. That we look for communities in our church. It may not be the whole church, but again, like-minded people. And that getting back somewhat to Nikki's thing too about fruitfulness is that we should really look for ways to encourage each other and encourage, you know, to say to one another, to appreciate. I think you're really gifted in this, and what you did was good, and that doesn't need to build pride. I think it's just encouragement. If you look at research on children who do, when people believe in a child and encourage them, they do better. They actually rise to what's been said to them. And so within local communities, small groups, whatever, if we, you know, a group sees, here's a guy who really feels a calling to go into politics, you go, well, encourage him. Pray for him. Or her, and so that there'll be people both engaged very much, say, in the political world, but being supported by Christian friends who are praying for it, and each other encouraging, you know, everybody encouraging each other. The gift that we may recognize in each other better than we do in ourselves,
mm-hmm.
And saying thank you, you know, thank you for.
That's right. Listen, I've got the signal that it's time to wrap it up. I'd like to spend a minute praying together. Let's just anybody pray a short prayer if you'd like to, and I will close in a couple of minutes.